It's May 12th, Hashkafa. We're taking up a question, which is an old question. It's good to be prepared with an answer pertaining to the status of women in halacha. And the basic status is that women are included, of course, in all the commandments, positive commandments and negative commandments. However, there is a distinction with regard to certain types of commandments, certain types of mitzvos, that women are exempt from. It's a general rule, and you'll see it has exceptions. But the general rule is that all negative commandments, whether they're time-bound or not time-bound, women are obligated in. Losaseis. When it comes to a losasei, it doesn't matter whether it's time-bound or not time-bound. When it comes to positive commandments, they're included. There's no difference with regard to mitzvasasei. Women have to do the positive commands, except positive commands that are dependent upon time, women are exempted from. That is, for example, shofar. Women are exempted from the mitzvah of shofar because it's positive command, mitzvah say, to hear the shofar. And, of course, the mitzvah is only on Rosh Hashanah. And the same would be true with regard to sukkahs. Sukkahs, mitzvah say, to dwell in the sukkah. Basukos teshu shivas yamim. You should dwell in the sukkah for 7 days. So, again, it's positive, it's time-bound. So women are exempt. Interestingly enough, even though there's a hekesh between Pesach and Shavuos, and women are chayiv in Pesach, women are obligated. That would be an illustration of the exception, that the rule has exceptions. The mitzvahs pertaining to Pesach, the positive commands, eating matzah on the night of Pesach, eating maror, etc. When there was a Beis HaMikdash, the fact they have to bring the karbon and so forth, women would be included. That's one of the exceptions. Well, just like Shabbos is an exception, or Kiddush on Shabbos. Well, Shabbos per se is a losase and an ase. It's interesting, because there's a losase of doing work. And then there's a positive, there's an ase of lishbos by Yom HaShvi, to rest on the seventh day. What the question thus arises is, what's the reason behind this? What's the reason that women are exempted from this category? Before we go further, it's an important point to mention that when we say that women are exempted and so on, it doesn't mean that they're excluded. There's a difference between exempted and excluded. Excluded would mean that they can't do the mitzvah, or if they do it, it's meaningless. That is not the case. It merely, if they do the mitzvah, it's not meaningless. They get the mitzvah, so they haven't been excluded. For example, if a woman wants to shake a lulav because she wants to get the fulfillment of the mitzvah, she can do so, and she gets the fulfillment of the mitzvah. According to Ashkenazic practice, she makes the bracha. She can make the bracha. Now, you can't make the bracha if the action itself does not constitute an action of mitzvah. All right, so there's a machlokas. The Sephardim don't have women making the bracha. The Ashkenazim do. That's an interesting halachic machlokas, which has to do with the character of the bracha. That is, can a woman say, Asher kedushanu b'mitzvosav, v'tzivanu? Can a woman say that? Because she's not commanded. So, we say that she can, because even though she herself is not commanded, but the activity that she's engaging in is an activity of mitzvah. It's a fulfillment of a mitzvah. So, you don't require that the person saying the bracha actually have the chiyuv, as long as the action constitutes the kiyum, the fulfillment of the mitzvah. And the Sephardim hold differently, that the factor which enables you to recite the bracha is that you yourself, your action, is an expression of the fulfillment of your chiyuv. That's a technical halachic machlokas, but all sides agree that she's doing a mitzvah. So that's an important point. But the question arises, what's the reason for this, for the way the Torah formulated it? It's very difficult to try and explain this with regard to the difference in the temperament, so to speak, between men and women. Both are Tselem Elohim, and one, you know, you can't say that one is better or superior or higher than the other. Each person has to define himself in accordance with his Bechira, how he uses his free will. So we've had great, great women. That's one thing about the Torah. It's very, very important. I know that there's a lot of always feminist-type attacks on the Torah, equality, so on and so forth. Why can't women have this position or that position? But that's very superficial to try and attribute it to the categories that they have in mind, because you take a look at the Torah itself and the way it treats women. The Avos, the Mahos, the Torah records differences of opinion, for example, between Avraham and Sarah about Yishmael. It was Sarah's idea that Yishmael had to be sent away. It was a very, very difficult thing to do. And Avraham, the Torah says that the matter was evil, was bad in the eyes of Avraham, al odos beno. So you see from there that there was a disagreement between the two. That's very, very significant to be aware of that. That's not the only case. That on this very issue, the influence that Yishmael would have on Yitzchak, and that that was a very daring position of Sarah, that not just to rebuke Yishmael, but that he had to be sent away from that environment, from being with his father. So you can well imagine how painful that was to Avraham, but aside from that, he didn't think it was necessary. And then you have God intervening and telling Avraham, Kol Asher Tomar Elecha Sarah Shema B'Kola. Everything that Sarah tells you, listen to what she says. Now, if this was a context of some type of a, what they would call a chauvinistic concept, approach, this is very, very significant on many levels. It's hard to imagine in that kind of a culture. You're not going to find this in those kinds of cultures which are male-dominated and women are genuinely inferior and pretty much are exploited to serve men. If that's the case, this would not take place. But certainly, it wouldn't be written about. Who would write it down this way? Even if a case occurred where the leader of the group was critiqued by his wife or whatever, and he had to get in, he'd want to keep it a secret. You don't want to set this up as an example, because it's setting up as an example not only that the woman didn't agree, but that God intervenes in favor of the woman. Who wants to make that known? It's another indicator, of course, that the Torah is min hashamayim, it's from God. If it was written by people, it wouldn't be written that way. But you see from that women are accorded a very high level. That's what the Chazal say, that she had the Bina Yisera. She had a additional insight. In this area, she was superior to Avraham in this area. Certain insight about the situation and the effects of Yishmael and so on and so forth. This is not the only case. Obviously, there are more cases. Even in the whole difference between Rivka and Yitzchak with regard to the makeup of Esav, it was Yitzchak who was deceived, clearly was deceived about Esav. And it was Rivka who recognized the truth. And she plotted and schemed behind his back to see to it that he would not do what he intended to do, to give the bracha to Esav, and to see to it that it should be given to Yaakov. And the Torah depicts that openly. So in that sense, she's the heroine of the story, and it's the implication is that she has a greater insight in this area than does Yitzchak. All of this indicates that the Torah is not trying to promote that position that men are superior and women are inferior. And of course, even that proposition wouldn't explain it. If that's the case, so why do women have to do all the mitzvahs that they do? It's only a few mitzvahs. It's not that many mitzvahs that they're exempted from because of this rule. And as I said, they're not excluded. They're just exempted from the obligation. So it can't be found, if you want to say that there's a difference, however you want to say it, there's nothing wrong with saying that women have different kinds of temperaments and so on and so forth, provided what you're saying makes sense. And I'm not going into that to say that women perhaps are more intuitive and men are more abstract. Whatever you want to make, there's nothing wrong with making those kinds of judgments. Whether they're true or not has to be seen. If they make sense and they correspond to the statistics and so on and so forth. We're not getting into that because even if that were the case, what difference would it make? Let's assume, for argument's sake, that we would say that women in general tend to be more quote-unquote emotional. Whatever we mean by that. So what does that have to do with the mitzvah seis zman grama? What does that have to do with positive commands? It's you have to correlate the two. And if it did somehow correlate, and it did lead to some kind of conclusion, even if you wanted to correlate it would be very difficult, because if you're going to say that there's something about the makeup of women that is antithetical to the character of those mitzvahs, so then why aren't they excluded? They're not excluded, I said. They could do it, just that they don't have to. So it's very difficult to take that approach. But I hear a question coming in. Just a qualification on what's being said. About if a person were to say that the temperament of women is different than of men. Well, you have it. That's an idea that's accepted even in the popular culture. The women are, from Mars, Venus? I don't know, though. Trying to depict what's important to a woman and what's important to a man. So, this is... Even if you say that men tend to be more abstract about a thing or logical, looking for the solution to a problem, whereas women tend to get much more involved in the emotional aspect of it. Whatever, what difference does it make? Each person has his own makeup, even amongst men and even amongst women. And the Rambam says people have different dispositions. He goes through the whole list of dispositions. By nature, some people are very, very generous. Others are very stingy. Some are very sensual. Others are to the opposite extreme, have very little desire. And he says that each person has to work with the nature that he has and direct it towards a certain disposition, the median point of view, the middle ground. So what difference does it make if man or woman? He doesn't make any difference over there. Each Torah, of course, is equally concerned with the perfection of women as it is with the perfection of man. That's why both are commanded in the mitzvos. In the majority of the mitzvahs. Men have a few more due to this factor. So what is it about these mitzvahs that create some type of a conflict? What's the conflict? There's a conflict between two things. The role of a woman. Besides the idea that a person is commanded in doing the mitzvahs, there are two dimensions. There are two dimensions that a person has to be concerned about in Judaism. One is personal, perfection of the self. That's one of the that's his prime responsibility, to perfect himself to the greatest extent possible. Selfish. The other responsibility he has is not directly to himself, but to the Jewish people, let us say. To the perpetuation of the Jewish people, to the perpetuation of the Torah system. And thus, it's not just the mitzvah of puruvu, just to have children and that's the end of the story. The framework of the mitzvah is to, there should always be a Jewish nation. It's to perpetuate the system. Of course, this comes along with the obligation, the responsibility to raise the children properly and to teach them Torah, and see to it that they will become, in their own right, they'll become observant Jews. and fulfill the mitzvos in the Torah, and they, of course, will then have the opportunity to perfect themselves, and they will have the responsibility to do the same thing, to have more children. The having of children, then, is a central obligation, objective. It's not just another mitzvah. Now, as far as that's concerned, once that's the case, you have to say that the Torah envisions, puts a tremendous amount of emphasis on the stability of the family unit. We did that yesterday. We said that the reason why the Torah is very harsh and even has the death penalty for striking one's parent confirms for us the tremendous significance of the role of the parent. See, that dimension. By the way, this explanation will help us to add a dimension to what we said yesterday in response to Morris's question. This is, in a sense, a continuation. That Morris's question was if the kavod that one has to show to the Rebbe is greater than to the parent, why is it that if you strike your Rebbe, you don't get the death penalty, and if you strike your parent, you do? Here we see another dimension. That is the institution. The institution of the family is of greater practical consequence, because without the family unit, you can't have the Rebbe unit, you can't have anything. Yeah, that's where. So the practical significance is very, very great. That is, you can't achieve the objective of the Torah without a very stable family unit in which the parents behave in a certain way and the children have respect for the parents and so on and so forth. This is very, very significant, then, in helping us to understand the answer we're going to give. It's a new dimension, even though, as I said, the answer has been given many times. Now, ironically, coincidentally, in terms of what we did yesterday, the ideas from yesterday, I think, come together with this, and it provides a whole new dimension, which is very, very important. I hadn't thought of this before. Thus, each member of the husband, the father, the mother, the wife, the Torah envisions a certain structure to the relationship. In general, of course. You can have certain exceptions, but in general, the role of the man is to be the breadwinner. He's supposed to go out there and provide the material needs, the earning a living, the house, that the Rambam says. That there's a certain order that a person should go through before he gets married and has children. He should get a profession, then he should get a house, and then he should get a wife. That's his responsibility. Now, when the child reaches a certain age, the father has to teach him Torah. But the nurturing of the child, that role of obviously having the child, goes together. Well, that's the maternal instinct. The maternal instinct has been implanted in the woman. There's a major difference between man and woman. It's a major basis. And her whole makeup, her whole nature, her instincts render her to be the one to do the nurturing of the child in the early years, which are the crucial years. Now, I know that in recent, in this generation, in recent years, there's been a lot of rebelling against that kind of thing. And there's a powerful notion that, because there's always this desire to rebel against the past, that this is just because it was part of a whole system in which men wanted to subjugate women and blah, blah, blah. And now the idea is that there's no real differences and women can take the place of men and men can take the place. It's all training. Everything is just conditioning and training. So they maintain that there's no reason why it has to be a woman. A man can do the same thing. He could be a nurse and he could. All of this has been refuted. Any intelligent person would recognize that there's no basis whatsoever. A man is not equipped. Obviously, there are cases where there's no mother present and the man has to take over the responsibilities. So you do the best you can. But it's not the way it was designed to be. A man is not designed for that. Someone who's not designed for something, if he works very, very hard, can learn how to do it, but it's not going to be the same as someone who works very hard at it and has the basic nature. Your whole emotional and your temperament is fully in line with it.
Rabbi?
See, for a man to wake up at 3 in the morning because a kid is crying and there's nobody around, he has to give him a bottle, he could do it, he could force himself to do it. For a woman, it's a different thing altogether. Now, once we've established that, the tremendous importance of the nurturing of the child in its early years, and this task falls to the woman by design. This is the way the Creator designed it. That's her role. And that's the way the ideal family unit would be established. The man goes off to acquire what the family needs and provides the foundation. The woman is there. She must be freed from anything which would interfere with this. That's how significant it is. It overrides. As important as the mitzvos are, when it comes to this, her engagement in this is more important. If there should be a conflict between the two. If there should be a conflict, that's why this explains exactly that it's only those mitzvos which are positive and time-bound. Negative she has to do. Negative is not a problem because it's not doing it. Negative is refraining from doing it. So that's not an imposition. That's not an interference. Even if it's time-bound, it's not an interference. Positive is something you got to put everything down and you got to get involved in the mitzvah. You got to build a sukkah, you got to get a lulav, whatever the case may be. And at that time, the child might need you. It's going to interfere. So the way the Torah dealt with this is, if you can't do it, you're exempt. You cannot have an obligation, because that obligation is the obligation which would interfere. Of course, there's a lot of different situations. A person can be free, even though she has a child. And she could have helpers, and then she can have all the time to do the mitzvah. So what the Torah did was, it left it to her discretion. If she sees fit, she doesn't have to do it. But if she wants to do it, she can get the benefit of the mitzvah. Because there is a benefit to be had from the mitzvah. However, the overriding concern, the greater endeavor for her too, in terms of her perfection, in her service of God. If a woman says she was going to, if a woman were to neglect her child to do a mitzvah because she wants to serve God by doing the mitzvah, then that would not be a service of God. Because it's a greater service of God to fulfill that which He designed you to do in this particular circumstance. So of the two, the taking care of the child is greater. You shouldn't put that aside for the sake of the mitzvah. But the Torah worked it. Now, of course, it goes across the board. Many people will say, well, what about single women? And what about after the children are grown? And so on and so forth. But in order to establish a point, to make the point, the significance of this point, the Torah is categorical. In general, the laws of the Torah are pretty much absolute. Lo plug. Because by doing so, first of all, you avoid a lot of problems. It would be more difficult if the woman was doing it when she was single, then she's going to want to do it when she's married. She's not. The system of the Torah is across the board. By exempting all women from mitzvah seishas man grama, it's also emphasizing how very, very important this point is. That is, that the care of the children in the early years is of paramount importance, and they shouldn't be distracted from that. So, but again, you see, what did the Torah do? It didn't say women can't do so, single women, so on and so on. All it said is they don't have to do it. But if they're really interested and they want to get the mitzvah, so they can do it. There's nothing that stops them from doing it. There's no need for the chiyuv to be there in order for them to get the benefit of Torah. That's basically my explanation. It was enhanced by our discussion yesterday as to the practical importance of maintaining the family unit, which is the reason for the harsh punishment of a child who rebels against his parents, and which is not the case for a student who would rebel against the teacher. It's not the same thing, even though the obligation to respect one's teacher is greater because he brings you to the world to come. When I'm speaking about a woman, I'm not saying that her attachment to the child is greater. That might be true also. I'm not getting into that. We're not talking about that. I'm not saying that it's her attachment to the child is greater than the father. What I am saying is that the instincts are there, the maternal instincts, which give her a greater desire to do these things, a greater satisfaction in doing that, a greater capability for doing these things. If your instincts are in line with a certain, let's say it's aggressive instinct, so you're more in line with sports and so on and so forth. So when you engage in those things, you're more into it and you do a better job than someone who doesn't have those instincts at all and he's just forcing himself to do it. That's what I meant. That the best candidate for a task is someone whose basic nature is in line with what it will require emotionally. Of course, he has to learn how to discipline himself and how to proceed and so on and so forth. But if he's doing something for which his nature has designed him and prepared him to get really great satisfaction out of that, the person has an inclination to be a leader. He has that inclination. He likes to take charge, likes to be in charge of things, get things done, and direct people. That doesn't mean that in and of itself is not necessarily going to make him a good leader. He has to learn what to do and how to deal with people and so on and so forth. But he'll have the drive to learn those things. And when he does these things, he'll have the energy. You see that people will spend tremendous amount of time for their organizations that they're leading. Why? Because they're getting a great deal of emotional satisfaction out of it. But a person who doesn't have that emotional makeup, but he has to do it, he's as a service, he has no choice, it's going to be much more difficult. You're not going to get the same results. That's the sense in which I mean it. It's questions being raised. Am I saying that it's more important to take care of the family than to do these mitzvahs? Thus, if a man didn't have a wife and he was left with children, you see, once the halachic system is set up, the halachic system is set up in accordance with the ideal. And so you have to differentiate between halachically and philosophically. Yeah, you might say the same thing, that a man in that situation who has to take care of little kids should be exempt from these positive commands. But that's a halachic issue. You can't say that halachically, because the halachic system has already been established, and if a man finds himself in a certain situation, he's still halachically obligated in lulav. So he would have to work harder to see to it that he does the lulav, even though he has to take care of the child. Now, of course, he can't abandon the child if any harm. I mean, there's other factors. There are other factors that come into play halachically to decide when a person is obligated or exempt from a mitzvah. So he could say, Onos Rachmana Patre. I'll give you an example. Let's say it's time to daven, and his wife had to take care of her father, is in the hospital, very sick, and she had to go visit him, and she left him with the kids. He has two or three kids, something like that, which is a big mitzvah. He has to watch the kids now. So he's hoping she'll be home in time so he could be able to daven. Okay, because he has to, these kids are, you know, demanding his attention, and they, you know, he can't just get up and daven. He's got to watch them. So, but he's chayev in tefillah. So what's he supposed to do? So that becomes a halachic issue. If he can get somebody, now his wife calls him and she's delayed in traffic, she won't be home for an hour, and by that time it'll be too late to daven. So what's he supposed to do? Well, I mean, if he can get somebody, pay someone a few dollars, watch the kids, if that's doable, so then he can do that and daven. If he can't, so then he can't daven. Honest, Rachmana Patre. I'm assuming, of course, that the situation is such where the kids are constantly need to be watched and he can't take his attention off them and he can't daven. So I'm just using that as an example. The fact that he's in a situation, or if it were time to do the lulav or anything like that, any positive mitzvah, if there was any positive mitzvah, all right, lulav. This case is easier because in tefillah, any diversion where a person can't concentrate, if he can't have kavana, he's exempt anyways. In fact, he's not supposed to daven if he can't have kavana. But that's a different story. So I was using an easier example. Let's say it's lulav. And he's stuck with the kids and he has to go get a lulav. It would be pretty similar. Halacha doesn't allow you to endanger the welfare of the children just to do the mitzvah. I say, if that was the case, that he had to watch these kids and he couldn't leave them. In point of fact, if somebody, I'm not looking at the practical. Practically speaking, it doesn't take long to do the mitzvah of lulav. I'm just using it as an example, or any positive mitzvah. That it would, philosophically speaking, he's obligated. But practically, if there was any possibility of harm or danger to the children, of course he watches the children, and he doesn't do the mitzvah. And that's onos rachmana patre. He's pater. He's exempt because pressing matters. He couldn't do it. That. You don't need something like that. There's other factors that would create an exemption as well. That's how you'd have to look at it.